We'll give it another minute. How's that? Looks like the weather's really quite nice outside, isn't it? Fewer people have come inside tonight. Well, we usually have a sold-out crowd, but I have a feeling that we have a one warm night in San Francisco, and so maybe a few people have taken advantage of it. Let me introduce you. Maybe we'll go through some of the housekeeping parts of the evening before we get to our program. First of all, thank you for coming this evening. It's good to see everyone here at the World Affairs Council. I'd like to introduce tonight's program, which is Iran and the West, Platforms for Dialogue. But it'll be, as I was talking with the former Prime Minister, also a look at religion and politics in general and how those two intersect. Our guest, of course, is Kjell Magne Bondevik, and he is the former Prime Minister of Norway, and he's currently the president of the Oslo Center for Peace and Human Rights, and I hope you'll tell us a bit about that when you open your speech this evening. My name is Marcos Kounoulakis. I'm a trustee here at the World Affairs Council, and we have a few other trustees here as well. We basically make sure that the World Affairs Council runs properly and that we get people to come to our programs, and we have radio recording engineers who come to make sure that the program is also put on the KQED program here locally at 88.5, and that plays on Mondays at 8 o'clock, and it's also rebroadcast across the country at various times. I'm going to read this bit about the World Affairs Council. The council provides a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and becomes the basis of informed action. And to learn more about the organization, in case you don't listen to the radio program or come to the programs, you can go to the website, which is itsyourworld.org. By the way, I mentioned our audio engineer. His name is David Ogilvie, and I'd like to thank him for coming out tonight. We do a fair amount of programming, and there's some really spectacular programming coming up in this month of October. And it'll be an opportunity to take a look at the discussions in the Middle East and some of the peace process from those who are players in this specific field. And so if you're here on October 22nd, which is a Thursday, we'll have former Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Olmert, and that'll be at the St. Francis. It'll start at 6:30, and it should prove to be a fairly interesting evening. And then the following week, on Tuesday the 27th, we'll be hosting the chief representative of the PLO to the U.S., and Mayen Arakat. And this event will be down at the Herbst Theater, which is where the United Nations Charter was signed, and that'll begin at 6:30. Then on Wednesday, the following night, on the 28th, the Council is going to host Iranian-American scholar Dr. Hale Esfandari, and you may recall she was the scholar from the Wilson Center who was under arrest in Iran recently. And she'll be here to talk about her arrest, and I think she's got a new book out as well. And the event will be here at the Council at 6 o'clock on Wednesday the 28th. And then finally, as we do in all of these events, we ask you to use your blue cards for questions. We'll try and have a good Q&A session at the end of the former Prime Minister's speech. And please turn off your cell phones and anything else that buzzes. I'll give you a moment to do that. So, it's my honor to welcome Norwegian politician Kjell Magne Bondevik, and he has twice served as Prime Minister of his country, and he's been a Member of Parliament. He's also served as Foreign Minister, but aside from these temporal ministerial positions, he's also got one which is non-temporal. He is an ordained minister and has served as Minister of Church and Education. So he has, in fact, in his own life, been able to intersect the question of politics and of religion. Following his career in Norwegian politics, the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan named Mr. Bondevik to serve as the UN's special humanitarian envoy for the Horn of Africa, an area that includes the troubled regions of Eritrea, Ethiopia, Somalia, and Djibouti. And he is deeply involved in promoting international human rights and interfaith dialogue. Mr. Bondevik also went on to help establish the Oslo Center for Peace and Human Rights, as I mentioned earlier, and that's based in the Norwegian capital, in Oslo, and there is one chapter here as well in the United States, in Minnesota. Currently serving as president of this Oslo Center, he oversees the organization's work in bringing together influential politicians, religious leaders, and academics into a much-needed dialogue on religion, tolerance, diversity, women's rights, and democracy. And so here to discuss his recent partnership with the former president of Iran, Mohammad Khatami, and how they've been working together to promote peaceful dialogue between the Islamic world and the West, I'd like to present to you Kjell Magne Bondevik. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. And let me start by saying that I'm now on a round trip in the U.S. organized by the Oslo Center U.S. Foundation. I started in New York last week on the Clinton Global Initiative Conference, and which is a very important meeting place also for us as ex-politicians. We meet many of our colleagues there, among them Bill Clinton himself. And we also use the opportunity in New York to have other important meetings for our center. As already mentioned, the center was established back in 2006 after I stepped down as prime minister. And the main idea behind is to make a good use of contacts and networks which some of us developed through our years in politics. To work mainly on leaders' level, leaders in the civil and political society, but with hopefully an impact on the grassroots level for people who are in need, poor and oppressed people. We want to make a difference for some who need it. That is my whole ambition. And it was many years in politics who developed this interest and the interest for international policy in general. But also my own personal background as an ordained pastor, I will come back to that. The Oslo Center, we are working mainly on three program fields. One is about human rights, and we are documenting abuses of human rights in countries like North Korea, where we have launched two reports about Burma and about Eritrea at the Horn of Africa, where we are launching a report now next week. We are also working on freedom of religion in Central Asia and mental health as a human rights issue. Secondly, we are working on what we call democracy and coalition building. We try to contribute to strengthen democracies in countries with rather new democracies, which are fragile, multi-party system, and even coalition governments. And I have, as indicated, a background of being member of four different coalition governments in Norway, prime minister for two of them. So in that regard, I have some experience. And we are working together with National Democratic Institute, NDI, here from US, especially in Kenya. They have now a grand coalition which came out of a violent conflict after the presidential election almost 2 years back. But they don't have so much background for such a coalition government. So we share our experiences on how we can do it and give very concrete advices and tips, ideas. Despite of all the differences between a country like Norway and Kenya, there are many which can be conveyed. We have also started up for Somalia and Mongolia. We are also working on the Freedom of Association project, which is a part of this democracy and coalition building program. Our third program, which I will concentrate on tonight, is about interreligious dialogue and politics and faith. Politics and faith in current global politics seem to touch upon some of the core issues of international relations today. Without a doubt, we are experiencing a renewed focus on religion in national and international politics. And that is interesting. Because some years ago, many said that in the future, religion will play a less important role. But that's not true. It's the opposite. Religion is playing an increased important role, almost all over the world. For me personally, faith and politics have always been interlinked. When I engaged in politics many years back, my motivation came from Christian values. I learned earlier that my religious belief and politics, governance, and church are different factors of society and should not be mixed up in a wrong way. For me, Christianity is first and foremost a question of my relationship to God, of the belief in Jesus Christ, and politics are, on the other hand, a way of organizing the society to the benefit for individuals and the larger community, no matter the religious beliefs. In my view, the division between religion and politics is central and clear, yet they are connected. As a Christian, I cannot and should not leave my faith and conviction at home when I go to work in politics. I bring with me some values and principles which also have meaning in political life. And for me, these are three core values. First, man is created by God in God's image and has an inviolable value. This idea of the human being will in turn lead to protect human life from the conception to a natural death and consequently also protect human rights. Second, the principle of what I will call sound stewardship. God gave us a responsibility for taking care of his creation. And this will lead to an engagement in environmental policy and for a fair distribution of economic resources. And thirdly, last but not least, the double commandment of love. To love God above all and to love my fellow human being as I love myself. Jesus summed up all other commandments in this one commandment. And this is the main inspiration for me. And this leads me to combat an unjust and troubled world. And especially the example of the life of Jesus, who struggled for social justice and to embody the calling of neighbor love. And I will say that I believe in a God who sees the world from the perspective of the weakest, of the children, and of the oppressed. We cannot and should not shut our eyes to poverty and oppression. We are all part of a global fellowship, and we must join together and find solidarity with all those who are struggling for justice. And my religious faith only underlines that priority. For more than 30 years, I have practiced politics in Norway. Started very young, selected to parliament when I was 26. During this period of time, I have experienced how Western academics and politicians tended to overlook the role of religion, perhaps as a consequence of our society's relatively secular cultures. Over the last decade, however, we have seen a renewed interest in religion throughout Europe and also other parts of the world. And this relates to different and interrelated topics on the international agenda, among them actions and incidents that led to the so-called war against terrorism. Furthermore, increased immigration from Asia, from the Middle East, from Africa to Europe over the last four decades has moved different traditions and religious beliefs closer to our own reality. While Norway was a rather homogeneous society built on Christian human values in the 1970s when I started in politics, the situation is different today. Now Norwegian towns and villages are inhabited by people of different religious, cultural and ethnic backgrounds. The new, more pluralistic Norway challenges the traditional understanding of what it means to be a Norwegian, ethnically and culturally. Transformation of diversity in Norway and Europe has become a cultural hot potato. Immigration and integration are in themselves highly complex issues relating to public, to political, social and economic developments. Despite that, debates on these issues have often been reduced to matters of Islamic-Western relation. Why is that the case? Why is Islam seen by many Westerns as being incompatible with and a threat to our values and our political organizations? I believe this is a result of a general understanding of Islam in our communities. Our knowledge of Islam is often stereotypical and based on misconceptions and on ignorance. A small digression in that regard. Christianity is the single largest religion in the world of today. Christians are scattered all over the globe. Thus, Christianity is practiced in various shapes and contexts. Still, we view the contrast between Christianity and Islam, to be much more vivid. But that is because we usually associate Christianity with believers in modern US and Europe, rather than those in more traditional societies, such for instance Ethiopia and Sudan. But for many Ethiopian Christians, whose religion is closely linked to local tribal and cultural traditions, their ideas and practices of Christianity contrast sharply with their Western co-believers. So we need to convey loud and clear some important messages. First, Muslims and Christians interpret their faith in many different ways. Muslims and Christians around the world exhibit a wide range of approaches and orientations ranging from ultra-conservative and fundamentalist to progressive or reformist. And further, remember that extremists represent a minor minority. Still, their influence has been immense. We must not allow the extremist, regardless of their faith or ideological stand, to dominate the agenda. It's therefore imperative that moderate and reformist voices within all traditions and religions engage in a common struggle to fight extremists and violence committed in the name of a specific religious or cultural tradition. Immigration to Europe goes several decades back. A large part of those who immigrated came from predominantly Muslim countries. From 1970s, religious and cultural dimension became an important social issue in relations between Muslim communities and the host communities in many European countries. This was a consequence of a drastic change in European immigration policy in the beginning of the 70s, with the lowering of the family unification. Consequently, Muslim presence in Europe changed from one of mainly male migrant workers to social community in a fuller sense with Muslim families living together. A backlash against Muslims in Europe first was observed in the public sphere in countries such as Britain and France in the 1980s. International events and concerns interfered into the domestic scene in many Western European countries. The Iranian Revolution was one of such important developments and created worries of Islamic fundamentalism. And especially two issues led to increased focus on the role of Muslims in Europe in the early 1990s. First, the Salman Rushdie's novel, Satanic Verses, and the death sentence issued against him by the Iranian supreme leader Ayatollah Khomeini. And second, a conflict in France over the use of headscarf for Muslim girls in public schools. The first issue also marked the Norwegian public deeply and led to protests and debates on the freedom of speech and the role of Islam in the Norwegian society. In 1993, the Norwegian publisher of the Rushdie novel, Satanic Verses, was shot outside his home in Oslo. He survived, but the incident continued to shape many Norwegian views on and attitudes towards Islam. Naturally. The underlying issue in all these debates was and still is there an inherent and inevitable incompatibility between Islamic values and the secular organizing principles of the Western European states? The short answer in my view is no, and I will come back to that. Scholars have argued convincingly that Islam has a history of pragmatism. Separation between religious principles and institutions on the one hand, and the temporary ruler of the state on the other. That was historically common. We have some exceptions today, especially Iran. With regard to practices on citizenship and political organizations, the answer is the same. There aren't any unworkable obstacles. I will argue that we Europeans need to be much more aware of the effect our policy on integration and immigration have on relations between Europe and Muslim communities around the globe. We are living in a globalized world. Hence, internal debates in our countries destructively feed on the global discourse relating to Islam-Western relations, and vice versa. We see how these debates create anger and frustration among Muslim communities also outside Europe. A case in point is the controversy over the Muhammad Kardums in 2006. You remember them. Danish and Norwegian newspapers published a serial of cartoons portraying Muhammad, one of them portraying him as a terrorist. The publications led to a global media event during February and March 2006. The pictures soon became part of various events, political projects, and diplomatic actions. Norwegian and Danish flags were set on fire by Muslim demonstrators in and outside Europe. The Norwegian embassy in Syria was smashed and was eventually burnt down. Danish products were boycotted by Muslim consumers in Muslim communities all over the world. The conflict was solved peacefully in Norway, inside Norway, not at least due to a national interreligious dialogue which had been going on for many years, in which relations across religious and political life had been built over time. In Denmark, however, they didn't have such a tradition. And the Prime Minister at the time characterized the event as the worst international crisis in Denmark since the Second World War. Today, I am mostly concerned about the negative attitudes towards Islam and the Muslims that are displayed in the frequent debates and in political statements. Too often they are based on harsh and unfounded generalizations. Again, such debates do not only create tensions and conflicts within our local communities, they also harm relations between people across continents and regions. Yes, Europe has a specific challenge and a huge responsibility to deal with these issues in different manner. Lawrence Wright, who wrote about Al-Qaeda and its road to 9/11, said in an interview with a Norwegian journalist, I quote, "Europe is the center of the Islamic Western conflict right now. You need to find a way to integrate Muslim minorities. That's our challenge." I believe, in that regard, that Europe has a lot to learn of the United States with regard to immigration and integration. While integration seems to challenge European national identities, modern America was built on immigrants. Immigrants from countries also such like Norway. 150 to 100 years ago, thousands of Norwegians left Norway to search for a better life in America. The motivation to leave their homeland was basically the same as immigrants coming to Norway today. We need to be reminded of our own history. In all fairness, we must also say that Norway and many other Western European countries are, by many standards, well-integrated societies. But we need a more proactive policy on integration. And we must deal with our negative attitudes towards people of different religions and cultural backgrounds. Europe has a history in creating otherness compared to America. Having in mind our history of both anti-Semitism and now Islamophobia, we must deal with this destructive part of our history and the culture much more in a much more thorough manner. I told you that interreligious dialogue in Norway was instrumental in dealing with the clash of the Muhammad cartoons. The case illustrates why such a dialogue is imperative to prevent and to solve conflicts. This is exactly why the Oslo Center for Peace and Human Rights is involved in developing avenues of international dialogue. One of our main partners in this regard is, as mentioned by the moderator, the former Iranian President Mohammad Khatami and his foundation for dialogue among civilizations. Khatami's engagement grew out of his life as a political and religious leader, in a particular country on the international scene with regard to Islam-Western relations, namely Iran. Khatami, together with Muslim intellectuals such as Malaysian politician Anwar Ibrahim or the former president of Indonesia, Abdurrahman Wahid, has framed the vision of dialogue between civilizations. This vision can be seen as a critique of the conflict vision of global relations. One of the most well-known expressions of this perspective is Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations. According to Khatami, it's not the history of clash, but of give and take among civilizations that is the norm of history. The United Nations proclaimed the year 2001 as the United Nations Year of Dialogue Among Civilizations, as suggested by Khatami. His foundation is today an essential strategic partner for the Oslo Center. I met Khatami the first time in Geneva back in 2003. We were both in office. We met at the conference. We had a bilateral meeting. And we talked about religion and politics. We made a joke because Khatami is a Muslim theologian. I am a Lutheran theologian. We're both politicians. So we said there are two countries in the world run by clergymen, and that is Iran and Norway. But we did it differently. But they had also much in common. We both understood the religious language and the political language. And we could have a good dialogue. So later on, when we both left office, Khatami contacted us in Oslo and asked for a cooperation. And we signed an agreement for a cooperation about Islam in the West. And we have had two conferences, one starting conference in Oslo back in 2007, and so one summing up conference in Tehran last October, and in between three workshops on topics like extremism and tolerance, politics and religion, and women, equality, and peace. We made a final declaration from the last conference. We highlighted there some shared principles and recommendations for further actions. Let me mention. We said that we recognize that our concerns and shared values are much more significant than our differences. We insisted to the international community to promote an active and more responsible and dialogical political and religious leadership, both on the national and international arena. And especially we urge religious leaders, given their authority and responsibility, to take a stand to contribute to advancing social justice and human rights, peace and stability. We urge them to promote sustained dialogue within and between communities and regions, to promote the empowerment of women to take active part in religious, political, and social life. And that was interesting. That was also said by Khatami and his people about women. We made also a plan of action, which we now will gradually implement. And now we will also try to reach out to people in the civil society and to youth, the leaders of tomorrow, with this message of reconciliation and common values. I have learned a lot also personally from this dialogue project. I have learned how integrated religion is in the way of thinking and behavior of many Muslim people. And for me as a Christian and even as a pastor, this has been an experience to reflect on. They very often take the religion more seriously than we and I do. I have learned much about how religion is integrated in many Muslim societies in a quite different manner than in Norway and other Western countries. I have learned about the abundant wisdom enshrined in Islamic texts and traditions. And the collaboration has taught me that we think differently on certain issues, for instance, with regard to gender issues, feminism, and the role of women in societies. And most of all, I will highlight that this cooperation has provided me with new knowledge and thus greater nuances in my understanding of other religions and societies. And finally, to collaborate with an Iranian reformist and political actor is not only deeply interesting and personally rewarding, it demands a fine-tuned understanding of international politics and of internal political processes within Iran. Iran is on the top of the agenda for the time being, and also here in the US. And I can maybe come back to that in the Q&A session and also elaborate a little bit on the current situation of the US-Iranian relations. After the presidential election in Iran in June, our cooperation with Khatami is naturally not now in the most active period, because we have to be careful as foreigners, be directly in contact with people in opposition in Iran for the time being. But we have contacts, and especially with his leaders also in Europe. Let me also mention that as a part of our work on interreligious dialogue in the Oslo Center, we have a project going on regarding holy sites. We know, unfortunately, that holy sites very often are places, are arenas of conflicts. We saw it in the Balkans, and we know it from Jerusalem. I talked to Bill Clinton after his last efforts at Camp David when he tried to achieve a peace settlement with Yasser Arafat and the Israeli Prime Minister at that time, Ehud Barak. And he told me that one of the main reasons why they didn't achieve an agreement was disagreement about the holy sites. It had to do with authority and access to the holy sites and so on. And it's so sad for all of us that the holy sites are arenas for conflicts and destroyed, as we see it in many Balkan countries also. So we have started a project where we have now drafted a code for holy sites, rules on how we can protect the holy sites. And We hope to get more religions on board and one day end up with this as a UN convention, hopefully. And when my colleague Olmert come back here later, you should ask him about the holy sites of Jerusalem. I will sum it up very simply. You don't get the political solution in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict without a solution on Jerusalem. And you don't get the solution on Jerusalem without a solution on the holy sites. That is the core of the problem. Let me finish with a few final remarks on dialogue. I have described how faith and politics in Europe too often become issues of tensions and conflicts. Under such circumstances, I would argue that dialogue is not only a meaningful tool. It is perhaps the only tool to build better relations on the ground between communities and across regions and religions. I would argue that the language of pluralism is that of dialogue, give and take. It requires criticism and self-criticism. And dialogue means both speaking and listening, not least listening. Therefore, we have two ears and only one mouth. Through dialogue, common understanding is revealed, as well as real differences are. Dialogue does not mean everyone at the table will agree with one another. That's not the goal. But pluralism involves the commitment to being at the table, to increase the understanding and respect, and to contribute with one's views, attitudes, beliefs, and commitments. Thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation. We do, in fact, have a number of questions already up here, and if you have questions, please make sure to fill out your cards and pass them up forward. But I've already received some, and in fact, a few regarding the issue that you touched on briefly, and that is, in fact, in the news today, the question of Iran, how Iran, the question of its elections, the behavior as a nation, given its development of weaponry, which is now quite public and which the president has also brought to the fore. How do you actually see the forces of reforms through your contacts and your relationship with the former president? And of course, he supported the opposition candidate from whom the election seems to have been stolen by many people's account. How do you, and of course there are demonstrations in the street for those who are trying to support President Khatami's candidate. Can you give us an analysis from your experience and from your relationship about how that's evolving and what we're likely to see?
Yeah, nobody can be sure what will happen. But we know that the opposition against the current regime is very strong. And it's still strong, despite that not so many people are out in the streets now, but we can understand why they are not. Because they are, of course, afraid of their lives and of their freedom. You must understand that. But it is a strong opposition around in the country. And we saw that during the election and after the election. And it's interesting also to see how the key political figures are operating. Because in Iran, it's a broad specter of political nuances. You have extremist and President Ahmadinejad. So you have the more moderate conservatives who in principle support him, but not in all cases. So you have the independent group in the parliament. So you have the reformist, and so you have the more radical Shirin Ebadi and her people. So there are at least five different groups. That's very interesting. And we have key political figures like Mohammad Khatami, with whom we cooperate, former President Rafsanjani. He was more in favor of economic reforms. Khatami more in with human relations and human rights reforms. And so you have Mousavi, who ran for presidency, and maybe he won. And it's interesting to see now to what extent they can coordinate their efforts. I do believe that things will happen behind the scene. We should also be aware of that the Iranian people are highly educated. There are many students, and especially female students. 60% of the students at the universities are girls. That is promising for the future. I think that in the long term they will not accept how they are treated. How should we approach them? I think it was right that President Obama reached out to hand and said, I'm willing to have a dialogue, whatever level they will start on. So the hidden nuclear plant was discovered. And that was, of course, a backlash. But despite of that, I think still it's a need for a dialogue, because to try to isolate Iran will make them even more extreme and will only increase the support of the current regime. It's only a dialogue which can break it up. And they should not only discuss the nuclear issue, which is, of course, is a great concern. There is a meeting tomorrow in Geneva about that between six other countries and Iran, among them U.S. But they should also, start a dialogue on issues where U.S. and Iran have things in common. Afghanistan, the drug traffic, and so on. And so hopefully gradually build up the necessary confidence so they can have concrete discussions also on the nuclear issue. But we know that this is also a very, very sensitive issue for Israel. And they are really afraid of that Iran is developing a nuclear bomb and see this as a threat. We have to understand also sometimes the arguments from the other side. Iran is saying, well, you are concerned about our nuclear program, which they say is only for peaceful purposes. But why are you not concerned about Pakistan and India and Israel, who probably also have nuclear weapons? And that's a good question. I think the only real answer on this question is that the vision should be a world free from nuclear weapons. And it's an increasing support for that vision and idea now. But on the way to that, of course, we must respect the non-proliferation treaty.
It's interesting to hear you discussing these things and to hear you put them in questions, in issues of moral equivalency, and I think that those are perhaps issues that will be raised by the audience as well on the possession of nuclear weaponry. But I think that on your second point, in fact, there has been a statement to try to achieve a nuclear-free world, and certainly there is a movement that has been led by this administration and in cooperation with your neighbors.
I appreciated very much the statement from President Obama where he supported this vision, and I myself in Norway coordinated an appeal from four former prime ministers of Norway with the same vision. So it's a growing movement working for this, and there were also some former high-level politicians in U.S. who made such a declaration some months ago.
And Scandinavia in general has been known for its anti-nuclear work over the many years.
Yeah, that's also true.
You mentioned, just to get back to Scandinavia, you mentioned a prime minister who had talked about who had characterized the tensions recently that had occurred as a result partly of this cartoon that had run editorially. That leader is now head of NATO and is in fact bringing that attitude, I would imagine, with him to his leadership role. Would you care to comment perhaps on how his confrontational understanding from that period may affect his leadership role in the NATO context?
Anders Fogh Rasmussen was a colleague of mine, and he was a good colleague. He acted in a way in the conflict about Muhammad Khartoum's, which I disagreed upon, because for instance, he also refused to meet ambassadors from the Muslim countries when the conflict was going on. So that only contributed to increase the tensions. But I think he learned a lot out of this experience. And this was used against him, of course, when he was candidate for being Secretary General of NATO, especially from Turkey. But he was finally accepted, and he gave some good statements after his appointment, also with regard to the relations to the Muslim world. So I don't think this will be a main obstacle for him now. I think we all learn.
Thankfully. I have a question here regarding your country specifically, and it's the question regarding Norwegian women and whether headscarves are allowed in order to avoid, whether that's allowed in that in your country, and if it's an issue.
Headscarves are in general allowed, and I am in favor of that. In a pluralistic society, we should accept religious symbols in the open society, being crosses for Christians who want to bear that, and being headscarves, and so on. But it was a debate in Norway with regard to using headscarves in the police, and that was a rather hot issue. And despite being in favor of the right to use religious symbols in society in general, I'm a little bit more in doubt when you come to the military forces and the police, where you are allowed to and you have a mandate to use force and even violence in special situations on behalf of the state. Then religious and also political symbols can be disturbing. So there is a rather broad consensus in Norway that in these fields it should not be used.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you seem to be, and clearly you feel this, that an expression of religious belief in a pluralistic society should be allowed in any form, and that it is really just an expression of speech in many ways. But of course there are countries in which that is not the case. How do you personally come to an understanding, or at least an ability to reconcile the realities that are true in non-pluralistic, non-democratic societies with those beliefs that you so strongly hold about Western pluralistic societies that do allow for this type of speech?
Yeah, we have two examples of countries that are declared secular states, Turkey and France. But are they more tolerant than Norway and US and other countries? In my view, not. Pluralism and tolerance is for me also to allow expressions of your faith, not to hide it and move it only to the private sphere. So I'm in favor of, in general, that we should allow religious symbols. That's for me obvious. But of course, it is a problem and a challenge that in many of the Muslim countries, they don't allow believers of other faiths to do the same. And that I will fight against, of course. No doubt. We know that in Iran and in other Muslim countries, there are huge problems for especially Baha'is, but also for Christians to meet, to express their faith, and especially to convert. And that is not acceptable in accordance to the freedom of religion. All these things should be allowed.
You know, I will stray from the questions for a moment because you brought something up, and the way you phrased your answer was very interesting to me, because what you said was, we must fight that. And I am curious to understand in what form that combat expresses itself when it comes to whether it be the disallowance of expression of religious representation within those countries, or even the de-Christianization, for instance, of parts of the Middle East. How are we to understand, whether it's within the context of the dialogue that you are promoting, or in other fora or contexts, that we are to combat that, or that you are combating that?
We are raising these issues. We have a frank discussion about it. And it has been very interesting. And we have not agreed. But we have had a very frank discussion, and I think they have got something to think about, because they are eager that their Muslim brothers and sisters should have their freedom in Norway and in other Western countries to practice their religion. And yes, I said, yes, they have. But why don't my Christian co-believers have the same rights in your country? And that is difficult for them to answer on. So this is a topic of a frank discussion. It has also to do with building religious buildings, for instance. In many Muslim countries, it's very difficult to be allowed to build a church. Not in principle, but in practice. In Norway, we have allowed to build mosques, of course, and as you have also here in the United States, it's obvious for us. So it's a long way to go, but the only way to change the situation in these countries is to have a frank dialogue.
And I appreciate this, and I hope you don't mind my dwelling on this particular issue, because I too believe that dialogue is very important, and I believe that our audience feels that dialogue is important. But at what point does the dialogue need to find its end point, and you as a politician understand leverage as well as anyone else? What are our points of leverage to try and, in fact, affect that change which we feel is so important in our society and should be perhaps in those as well?
In general, I will say the human rights. The human rights are the limits for what I can accept. And that has been a very interesting discussion in itself, because I have emphasized through our dialogues with Khatami and his people that human rights are universal. There are no national borders for the human rights. In principle, they agree. In praxis, they implement the human rights rather differently from us. But I will say human rights represent the limits for what we can accept in a dialogue. But I don't believe in isolating them and not talk to them about this. The only way to promote human rights is to discuss them.
So the promotion of human rights in multiple fora and in various dialogues, and perhaps even through the ratification of treaties and things of that sort. And have we seen some movement in some countries?
Oh yes, we have. We must not talk about the Muslim countries as a homogeneous unity. There are huge differences. Take a country like Morocco. It's rather pluralistic. They have implemented in a rather good way many or most of the human rights. And also for the women. And they have changed family laws to the benefit of women. So that is one rather good example that there are huge differences between the Muslim countries. And that has also been very interesting in our dialogues. It has very often been more discussions between Muslims than between us as Westerners and Muslims.
I've got a question here, because the question, since you've been discussing Muslims for a good part of your speech, the question here really is a question of our perception and also of the loud voice that extremists have as opposed to the more moderate voices that exist out there within any religion. And it says extremists everywhere seem to have the loudest voices. How can that be changed?
Yeah, that is in a way obvious and in nature that the extremists have the loudest voices. We also know that the media love the extremists, because media love conflicts. They don't love dialogues. So that's also a problem in itself, so we can get an impression of that the extremists are in majority. In fact, they are not. It's a minority. But of course, they make much trouble. So therefore, I said in my speech, we must not let the extremists take over the agenda. And that means that we must be engaged in dialogues with people who are willing to have a dialogue. And that we must in that way try to take over the agenda and to marginalize the the extremists.
I have a very broad question here, and it's from Wayne Berman, and he asks, given your religious beliefs, how do you feel about the importance of and the consequent need to control world population so that it does not outstrip finite resources? And of course, that has many implications, so
oh, yes.
I will allow you to answer that question.
Well, I do agree that it's a concern with the growth of the world population. And we have to have different approaches to avoid that. One is that I do believe that education in itself is helpful. If people are educated, I think many of them will not have as many children as many have today. That's one thing. Of course, the other is increasing of the living standard, because we know that many children, for many people in the developing countries, that's a sort of a pension, a life insurance. And if the living standard is improving, they don't have the same need of that. And thirdly, I'm also in favor of family planning. For me, as a Christian, that is not the problem. Abortion is for me a problem, because that is to take life. Family planning is to prevent, and that is just another thing for me. So abortion is not the means for me to keep the population down, but family planning is.
There's a question here from Lois Roberts, and it is there any way in which you feel the U.S. can improve the situation in Afghanistan, which is, of course, next to a country you've been working with, without sending 20,000 to 40,000 soldiers in? And I think the question also reflects whether or not you feel that there's any way that the interfaith dialogue or any other means through your Scandinavian and United Nations relations can help improve things.
Yeah. Afghanistan is a common challenge for us, because we are allies in NATO. And we stood up for U.S. after the attack 9/11, in accordance with paragraph 5 in the NATO charter, and it was also a mandate from the UN to act in Afghanistan against Taliban and Al Qaeda. That was very different from Iraq. I opposed the U.S. invasion in Iraq because there was no mandate from the UN at all, but that's another story. But back to Afghanistan. I know that it's a hot issue here in the U.S. now, if you shall increase the presence of troops in Afghanistan. That's up to U.S. to decide, of course. But it is a fact that we have not solved the problems there. And I am convinced, despite I'm in favor of the military presence there, that it will be impossible to solve the Afghanistan issue with military means alone. That will never work. You have to have a multi-approach, diplomatic, political, and also with humanitarian assistance and especially education of the Afghani people. That is the only way that it can work. If U.S. in addition will send more troops, I understand that Barack Obama wants that, because they don't have the necessary control. Or we don't have the necessary control, because Norway also have troops there, of course, much, much less. So I think it must be a combination of military means and other means.
A question in reaction to the question that you brought up about the world's holy sites and their protection and the resolution of their status. And the question from the audience is, would it be possible for the United Nations to administer the world's holy sites? And it talks about all the multiple areas in which those holy sites exist.
Oh, yes. Well, I think it will be difficult for UN to really control and run all the holy sites all over the world, because that is thousands or millions of holy sites. So that must, in my view, in principle, be up to the local congregations and denominations to do. But what I do think is a good idea is to get the UN Convention on Holy Sites, some main principles on how they, this should be managed. And that's what we are working for in our project. We have already approved on code for holy sites among the participants at two conferences we have had in Norway, with representatives on a rather high level from the three Abrahamic religions. Now we will want to enlarge this to the other religions, to bring in UN, and we are already in contact with UNESCO, which is a UN institution for such issues, and working with them. And so hopefully one day we hope this can be approved as a UN convention.
And moving from the multilateral international institutions of the United Nations back to Norway, one of our audience members says, given its small population, how do you explain Norway's big involvement on the world stage in the Middle East peace process, Sri Lanka, the UN, and international development missions all over the world? And is it, and I will add it as an aside, is it because of the oil money or is it something else?
No, it started before the oil money. I don't think that is the reason at all. Well, of course, it gives us a good economic situation, but that's not the main reason. Well, there are, I've been thinking about it. I think there are different reasons. First of all, Norway is so small, so we are not considered to be a threat to anyone all over the world. So we can come and be engaged, and they don't feel that we threaten them. We are threatening them. That's and one first important point. Another point is that we have no colonial past. And that is a big advantage, especially, of course, in African countries. Thirdly, we have many non-governmental organizations working in many countries all over the world. And very often they are building up confidence on both sides of a conflict. And let me give you some examples of that. In Guatemala, Norway facilitated peace talks. It started in 1990. I was the Minister of Foreign Affairs at that time, so I had the honor to receive them in Norway, where they met for the very first time, representatives of the government and the guerrilla. And it went on for 6 years. This process started by a Norwegian NGO in Guatemala, Norwegian Church Aid. And they had access and confidence on both sides of the conflict. And so they asked us in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, can we take over and facilitate the peace process? And we did. The same happened in Sudan, where it was a conflict between the Christian-dominated south and the Muslim-dominated north for many, many years. And Norwegian NGOs worked there, and they achieved confidence on both sides. And so they came to the Minister of Foreign Affairs and asked the Norwegian government, can you come on board and facilitate a process? And Norway and U.S. together did that. And the Minister of International Development Assistance in my two governments, she was very active and helpful in that. And it led up to a peace agreement in 2005. Still, it's a problem, big problem in Darfur, but within North and South, it is now peace. So these are two examples on how this works. Another point I will add is that Norway has a tradition of not leaving a conflict area after a settlement of a peace agreement. But we stand there. We stand with them afterwards. Because it's not just to call the parties to the table and say, now we have to negotiate on a peace settlement, and so we sign, and so we leave. That's not recommendable. But to follow up, for instance, with development assistance, to improve the living conditions, so people really acknowledge that peace is helpful. That is very important. And we have a tradition for doing that. We have now 1% of GNP in international development assistance from Norway. We are on the top of the list now. But of course then, the oil is helping us.
Well, I'm so glad that the oil is helping Norway. It certainly gives you entree to talk to many of these countries as well, in that you're in other forums aside from your religious forums. You get to discuss the price of oil and how to work with these other countries in trying to achieve energy prices that are helping us drive our cars here in California and the rest of the United States. We want to thank you for being here, Kjell Magne Bondevik, and for providing us with your thoughts and your insights. We wish you well with your work on peace and on interreligious dialogue. And we hope you come back to San Francisco again. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me here to the World Affairs Council and for the opportunity to speak to you and for your very good questions. So all the best. Peace be upon you.